to God and God only.
Well, when you worship your own desires, for example, avid materialistic culture, avid individualism, you have social breakdown and decay. If you look at the Children's Society report that was published in 2009, it came to the conclusion that our societies are breaking down because of what? Avid, excessive individualism. What's in it for me? I'm all right, Jack. And that, in a way, is worshipping the ego, is worshipping a false god. So it does have negative consequences in society, definitely.
Associating partners with God is an utter misjudgment. Now, that's because Allah is the reality, and what He invokes besides Him is nullity. Chapter 22, verse 62, He is the only source of good, perfection, or existence. This implies those who evoke others besides Him are under an illusion.
But fear is only one leg of worship. The other very important component of worship is hope. Hope to go closer to God and to be included in His favor and mercy. Hope to be good enough to be loved by God and to be granted His love in our hearts. It's only through these two components of fear and hope that the true worship is realized. And that is something that should be offered only to God and no one but God. In fact, it is through worshiping God that we can expand and develop our God-given faculties. Associating partners with God would not only stop that process, but it is showing ingratitude towards our Creator. It is only by acknowledging that all beauty comes from God and all praise is due to Him that man can be accomplished. Join me in the next episode of Discovering Islam to talk more about the creation of man. Until then, peace be with you.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam. Thank you for having me.
Welcome. Well, we are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting, according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Let me start off this episode with this question, Sheikh. Since we think that taking tablets or pills for treatment is not regarded as eating or drinking, or as you mentioned in one of the earlier programs, as a supplement, for example, in the common view, would taking those pills and tablets void the fast?
It definitely impacts the fast. It affects the fast. Because taking tablets through the mouth is a kind of eating, though in common view it is not considered eating, but it is a kind of taking. Just as you take food, you also take pills. And taking tablets through the mouth does invalidate the fast.
Mm. During the month of Ramadan, a husband or a man had sexual intercourse with his wife, with her consent. What's the rule concerning this?
Well, having sexual intercourse during the month of Ramadan is one of the invalidating agents, and it's strictly forbidden for a man and his wife to engage in sexual activities which result in, for example, in ejaculation, or, for example, having the intercourse itself.
Mm-hmm.
So it is forbidden. And if it both of them engage in a consensual sexual activity and it results to having sex or ejaculation, the fast becomes void.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be necessary for both parties for both the individuals to give the qadha of their fast and also give a penalty, which is called in legal parlance. It is called actually kafara. So they have to give kafara, which is, you know, to fast for 60 days and feed 60 people, because if they do it deliberately, this kafara becomes payable.
Mm.
And of course, not only kafara, but also they have to give the qadha of the fast as well.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, thank you very much. Let's have a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program. I just wanted to have you a question quite related to this, but let's leave it, after the break. Stay with us.
Ya Allah, thank you for another chance standing at my door. Ya Allah, you've given me hope. Deliver this gift right to my home. Marhab, marhab, ya Ramadan. Ahi qulubana bil Qur'an.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Mama Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawhid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting. Sheikh Tawhid, before the break, I asked you a question regarding sexual intercourse, which you said that, well, obviously it requires a penalty,
yeah,
right?
Kafara
and
both.
Yes, both actually. But what if the couple have a foreplay, basically, all right,
yes,
before their sex, and without, they don't come to the orgasm or the ejaculation of the semen in the month of Ramadan while they are fasting? Does this invalidate their fasting?
Well, foreplay in and of itself does not make the fast void, as long as the both of them are confident that it will not result in ejaculation. You know, there are many other sexual activities like kissing, hugging, and, you know, touching each other actually. All of these practices are allowed. As long as they are confident that these acts of sexual activity do not lead to some kind of orgasm or some kind of ejaculation for both parties, so the fast will not be rendered void.
I see. You talked about the invalidating agent for fast. Would you tell us about the all of those invalidating agents? What does invalidate fast?
Yeah, there are a number of things which invalidate the fast. And of course, there are 9 things,
mm-hmm,
which invalidate the fast. One of them is eating, the other one is drinking, and then the sexual intercourse is strictly forbidden. It is also one of the invalidating agents. We discussed it. And then an act that causes semen to come out, like, for example, masturbation, which is a grave sin, it is strictly forbidden. And inshallah, maybe if we make time, we will discuss it.
Mm-hmm.
And then each of these invalidating agents that I just enumerate here, will have their own, has its own details and you see conditions which can be discussed in another episode, inshallah.
Mm-hmm.
And then failing to make ghusl for menses, for janaba, for nifas until the morning adhan. You know,
mm-hmm.
if a woman is in the state of janaba or in the state of monthly period or maybe in nifas, and she deliberately delays the you know, the ghusl which is required to be performed before dawn, so it's also one of the invalidating agents. And then enema, which is to insert some kind of liquid into the rectum.
Mm.
You know, I should say also that, for example, if someone insert something hot, like something, for example, let's give the example of suppository.
Mm-hmm.
If it is inserted in the rectum because of the temperature, some people might have high temperature,
mm-hmm.
so it is sometimes becomes necessary, that will not affect the fast. But if liquid is inserted through the anus, it will definitely make the fast void. So this was enema was the fifth one, and then the sixth one is vomiting. If a person deliberately throws up and vomits something which is in his stomach, then it will make the fast white. Number seven, to tell a lie regarding God and Prophet and the infallible Imams as an obligatory precaution, to, for example, to ascribe something lie. Ascribe or tell some a lie,
mm-hmm.
regarding God, okay, it will affect the fast as an obligatory precaution. His Eminence exercises precaution in this regard.
Mm. This was Prophet and Imams.
The Prophet and the infallible Imams, and of course God. Okay, if you said something that God said and said such and such thing, well, God never said that, okay,
mm-hmm.
and you ascribe something false to God, mm-hmm. well, God never said that, okay, if the fast becomes white. The same is the case with the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, and also the infallible Imams and Lady Fatima Zahra, salamullahi alayha. So if you ascribe something false to them, the fast becomes white as an obligatory precaution.
Mm-hmm.
So number eight.
Okay, let's leave it up to the after the break. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back, continue our program and continue the invalidating agents of fasting after the break. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/Ian. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, 'cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We're still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting in general, and in particular, Sheikh Javid, you were talking about the invalidating agents.
Yeah, we were talking about ascribing false things to God, the Prophet, infallible Imams, and as I said, based on the fatwa of all the religious authorities, ascribing false things to those noble figures, the Prophet and the Imams, and also God, and the Lord of the creation,
mm-hmm.
Is not permissible under any circumstances. It will affect the fast as an obligatory precaution. Now, the eighth one is allowing thick dust to reach the throat.
Yes.
For example, if you know there is dust somewhere, for example, in a room, and you enter that room, it's so dusty that you cannot see things. It's thick dust.
Yes.
And when it comes to thick dust, you should see what the common people consider the dust as thick.
Mm.
If in common view, it's called because it is something is called as thick dust.
Yes.
Then it becomes an invalidating agent, and this again is based on obligatory precaution. So it, for example, smoking also comes under the very category because it's a kind of. Let's say dust. It's not dust, mm-hmm. but it's smoke yes. Going into something. It is something like dust, but it goes into your throat without you wanting to inhale it.
Yes.
So it is not permissible, and it will make the fast wide as an obligatory precaution. Then there is the ninth thing, which is submerging the whole head under water. Submerging the whole the head under water. We know that. Submerging means that you, for example, jump into the water, for example, a lake or a swimming pool, and all of your body is covered by water. You submerge and you immerse your head underwater. This immersion is not permissible while fasting.
Mm-hmm.
And it does not make any difference whether you are fasting, you are observing a wajib fast or a mustahab fast. It definitely makes your fast wide according to His Eminence, according to some of the religious authorities. There are, I said, this is a matter of dispute and controversy.
Mm-hmm.
Some scholars, including, for example, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, is of the view that submerging your head underwater it does not affect your fast. So mm-hmm. it's permissible to swim in the month of Ramadan and to yes. dive underwater in mm-hmm. the month of Ramadan according to him. But according to Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, one should avoid submerging. So of course swimming is permissible
mm-hmm.
and pouring water on your head is permissible. It does yes. not affect because normally when you pour water on your head, it does not make your fast you void.
Mm-hmm.
You can pour your water on your head, and it's in common view, it's not considered to be submerging your head in water. If you want to stand under a waterfall, again, it's not considered to be a kind of immersion underwater.
Yes.
You just like you stand under a fountain, let's say the shower, you go and take a shower and the water
yes.
comes on your head.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's not considered to be submersion in the common view.
I see.
So ghusl, and of course, the fast is not made void.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, as the host of this program. And on behalf of the rest of the crew, we wish you farewell and ask you to keep us in your du'as and remember us in this blessed month, Ramadan. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Oh Allah, please unite us and guide us to paradise. Oh, and guide us to paradise. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show we care. 'Cause Ramadan is here. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light, and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, in which we try to criticize a movie with religious or spiritual themes. Well, for that, in fact, we decided to criticize a movie in that line of, you know, religious nature, which is called Celestine Prophecy, produced in 2006, directed by Armand Mastroianni. It's about a school teacher by the name of John Woodson who loses his job and decides to visit Peru and, you know, to look for a manuscript, and that leads him, in fact, to a kind of awakening. I invited two of my friends and guests or guest speakers to the studio again, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Yasser. Brother Yasser, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the program.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Always a pleasure being with you, my dear brother.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Abdullah, salam alaykum. Welcome to the studio.
Wa alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Before I ask you questions regarding the criticism of the movie Celestine Prophecy, produced in 2006, let's take a short break by listening to a part of this movie, and then we'll be back and continue the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
Fingers together like this.
Okay.
Go ahead. You're going to look at the space between your fingers.
Back to the program. Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio with me, Mamajad, hosting this program. We are criticizing the movie Celestine Prophecy, produced in 2006, directed by Armand Mastroianni, with the help of my friends and guest speakers in the studio, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Yasser. Sayyid Abdullah, what's the overall message of the movie, or that's what the movie is trying to, you know, portray about, especially spirituality and personal transformation?
The main message, in my opinion, was that because they made it very clear from the beginning that as human beings we evolve, there needs to be an evolution. Mm-hmm. And you can see that projected in one of the scenes.
Yes.
So what's next? Like, what is the next thing in the human evolution? And that was pretty much the start of the movie, where the movie was about to take place.
Yes.
So they basically trying to say that human beings, they constantly need something to keep them improving. So we tend to God, and apparently God helped us to a certain extent, mm-hmm. and then we moved beyond God because science came in. So before science, everything that happens, we say, okay, this is an act of divinity, this is act of God, this is act of this, because we could not explain it.
Mm-hmm.
Now we can explain it. We took God out of the equation. God is no longer necessary.
Right.
So we turn to science. Now, what's the problem with science? Science cannot make your life better. Life cannot help you. It might make your life easier, but it cannot help you internally, mentally. It cannot help you. So how do we evolve out of that? And this is where the movie comes in. It's like, now you can have this out-of-body experience. You can have this spirituality. You can connect with other people. You can take energy. You can move energy. You can do this secretism, whatever it's called. You can do. You can move to a new age concepts where you are no longer bound by the human material world. You can extract your soul, you can go places, you can. So they basically go more and mainly on the spiritual aspect. So now spirituality is the new thing.
I see.
But now what they failed to do is, this spirituality, where is it coming from? You can't just become a spiritual one day. Like in the movie, they made it sound very simple. You look at something, you focus at it, and your energy is out there, and then everything changes. That's just nonsensical, right? In any term.
Yes.
So basically, what they're trying to do is they're saying simply, we need to evolve. So we managed to cross a lot of boundaries. We managed to cross religion. We managed to cross science. Now it's up to you to improve yourself from within by directing your energy, by looking at things. And this is a concept, especially back in the day, it was very popular, mind you. And based on that, I think even the movie and the book and The Secret was written based on that as well.
Yes.
Based on that energy that you can change things around you and change your surroundings. So they try to say, we need to evolve.
I see. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break by listening to a part of the movie Celestine Prophecy, produced in 2006, directed by Armand Mastroianni. And then we'll be back to continue the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
How it all came to be. My life seemed to be a part of everything right up to now. Everything made sense. Growing up at the lake, working with kids, trying to understand history. I spent my whole life thinking there was something more.
That's the sixth insight. It says we are part of a larger flow of evolution. We are here to do something. And if we are true to that purpose, we'll help move humanity towards the world you saw.
But that's just it. I don't know what I'm supposed to do.
That's because you're not through yet. How to know what to do next is the seventh. You have to discover your guidance.
You're talking about hunches, right? Intuitions? I've seen Will have that.
If you stay alert, you'll notice certain ideas, images coming into your mind. They're there to guide you. Follow them and the coincidences begin to increase. Just step into the flow.
I don't think I've ever experienced that before.
You just need to open the door again. Get some more energy. You remember how I felt on the cliff? How the world looked?
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio with me, Mama Jawad, hosting this program, and Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Yasser, my guest speakers. Well, we are trying to criticize the movie Celestine Prophecy, produced in 2006, directed by Armand Mastroianni. Well, Brother Yasser, you know, one of the major themes or the concept which is very much discussed in this movie is synchronicity, right? Would you please shed some light on this?
I don't think it's focusing on synchronicity too much. I think one of the issues that the movie focuses on is the way humans interact with one another. And one of the scenes that show it was the scene of at the end between one of the characters and the little girl at the Inca ruins that was mentioned. And more to do so with this transfer, which is something good, the way that human beings interact with one another will enable the human being to go from individuality to a concept of this community. If you look at it in this way, then it is something very profound.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is what we're all aiming for. A utopia on earth is not something that is based on an individual, but rather it is based on a community of people who share the same values and the same principles. But obviously, in this concept, based on this, the divine teachings of a particular individual.
Mm-hmm.
The Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam came to create a community, not just an individual. I mean, we have, for example, in Islamic teachings, many things that point towards this. Salatul Jama'ah, for example.
Right.
Where the energy, again, the word energy is not something I would like to use because I may not agree completely with the word energy because that still remains physical.
Mm-hmm.
This is something else.
Right.
Right, so the particular perfections that each individual has, when it comes together, creates something else.
Mm-hmm.
It forms something better.
Right.
So it's not synchronicity. It is this conforming in a positive manner. It is sharing in a positive manner.
Mm-hmm.
Where I have something that I'm giving to you, and you have something that you are giving to me. And both of us, because of the sharing, are being elevated, are transcending. This is what I think the movie is trying to show.
I see.
But I don't think it also did try to keep God within it to a certain extent.
Yes, as was in fact reflected in the first insight, which is synchronicity is the language of God.
Yeah. So in terms that, you know, that we are become in sync with the world around us, with people around us. But the only way to do that is to share.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Brother Yasser. Let's take a short break by listening to a part of the movie Celestine Prophecy, produced in 2006, directed by Armand Mastroianni, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
You're making a bad mistake, both of you.
He was undermining your confidence, taking your energy. Now you know what it feels like when someone does it to you.
I felt weak. I couldn't think.
He's just one more controller. But you're probably gonna have to deal with him, so you'd better figure it out.
Wait. Is that in the prophecy too?
There's a world of energy that we are all going to understand. It's the real human condition. Energy is what we all want. But we're stuck battling for it with each other instead of finding it in ourselves.
Back to the program. Viewpoint, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio, with me, Mahajad, hosting this program, and Brother Yasser and Syed Abdullah, my guest speakers in the studio, helping me criticize the movie Celestine Prophecy, directed by Armand Mastroianni, produced in 2006. Well, Syed Abdullah, how does the movie's portrayal of synchronicity compare to the real world experiences of synchronicity? Would you talk about synchronicity and the idea behind it or the philosophy behind it, and then how, did the movie portray that concept?
Well, in the movie, the concept of synchronicity, is the central role of the entire movie, where it portrays a series of, coincidence that leads to a new insight. So they make it in a way where you go through a series of things that will lead you to insight. It's not just random. So you have to go through the nine keys or the nine gates or the nine whatever they want to call them in order to reach this synchronicity and this peace of mind. So this is the central theme of the whole movie was that. Now, comparing that kind of synchronization where you use your own energy to move forward, compared to the real world, obviously there's a huge difference because the real world is really messed up. If you talk about this on a personal level, then yeah, it might make sense. But once you start to interact with other people, it becomes really hard. And you can see that very clear in the movie, that every time they're trying to sync themselves and sync themselves with other things around them, they get interrupted. Whether he's looking at a plant and he gets interrupted, whether he's trying to sync with other people and he gets interrupted, or people. And even that, I think at the end, the lady says, hold on to what, you know, and then they just couldn't. So basically, it's hard dealing with the real world and the messiness of the real world. And it's very hard to get synchronized in that kind of sense that the movie is trying to portray. Now, interestingly enough, as Muslims, our whole life is based on
synchronicity. Yeah.
We don't have anything random. From the moment you wake up until the moment you go back to sleep, your life has been designed for you. There's nothing called random. This is you can do, this is you can't do. This is makruh. This is not recommended, this is recommended. This is wajib, this is, you know, must, forbidden, you cannot do. So you're basically walking on a very synchronized path of life. You actually going with the current of life. You're going, even if scientists these days, they say the time of prayers are actually synced with the energy of the world. I don't know, I'm sure if you've heard this. So as certain times, like for example during Dhuhr, is a time where the energy of the whole earth itself is at its best, and the whole world and everything being is moving, and then when you pray you move with it as well. So So we are synced. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, no, you have very synchronized with everything around you. To make it more clear, Allah even said, okay, I'm going to give you actions that you have to sync with. For example, salah, like Brother Ibrahim mentioned, hajj, for example. And we have a lot of ibadat where it has to be done or it can be done in groups where you can see how synchronized it is. So as Islam has this as the core of its faith, unlike other religion where you do as you like and then go to a box and ask for forgiveness.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Asir, for your nice answers and contribution to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, in which we try to criticize the movie Celestine Prophecy, directed by Armand Mastroianni, produced in 2006. Of course, we didn't finish the criticism of this movie, and hopefully we'll do that in the upcoming episode. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Relax your focus just a bit. What do you see?
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Arash, located in the north of the Persian Gulf in Bushehr province, is a gas and oil field jointly owned by Iran and Kuwait. Over the past 60 years, both countries have acknowledged each other's rights to a share of the significant resources in the field. Surprisingly enough, the Supreme Council of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council has recently issued a statement claiming that only Kuwait and Saudi Arabia have sovereign rights over the field, raising Tehran ire. The Islamic Republic of Iran has reiterated that it cannot stand any violation of its national sovereignty and territorial integrity. It's just another tension underway in West Asia. What's the significance of Arash gas and oil field? What is Kuwait's position? What is Tehran's position? Why is Saudi Arabia engaged in this dispute out of the blue? Has there been any attempt to reach a deal? And if yes, why hasn't it borne any fruit? These and more on this edition of Iran Today. The offshore field known as Arash in Iran and Doreh in Kuwait has long been a source of contention between these two countries, grabbing headlines from time to time. فرزین سوادکوهی است، an energy journalist based in Tehran.
به نظر اومد که میدان مهمی میتونه باشه به لحاظ اقتصادی برای ما.
The Arash field, with its significant potential benefits for Iran, Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, has yet to be developed due to various factors. Following the Islamic Revolution's victory, Iran attempted to initiate the development process. However, unforeseen circumstances continually halted progress. One of the primary obstacles was the ongoing disagreement regarding the field's ownership, which further complicated the project's advancement.
The Iranian Ministry of Foreign Affairs has given a protest note to Kuwait's ambassador to Tehran over the country's one-sided statements on the Arash natural gas field, which Iran shares with its southwestern neighbor. Mohammad Ali Beik, an assistant to Iran's foreign minister and the head of the ministry's Persian Gulf department, said, "Making one-sided claims in various statements and through media undoubtedly cannot be a step forward to resolve the issue, and will not establish any rights for the party uttering such assertions. We also talked to Mohammad Sadegh Mehrju, a senior energy expert. Mr. Mehrju had more to say about the history of Arash and the dispute around it.
What is the Kuwaiti-Iranian dispute over the Arash gas field?
The Arash field was initially discovered in 1967 as an exploration block designated for petroleum exploration. Arash, a joint exploration block, is situated close to the Esfandiar field, which is shared among Iran, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. It lies approximately 10 kilometers away from the Abu Zar and Surush fields. The ongoing dispute revolves around border claims. Using the 1982 Law of the Sea Convention, LOSC, in its argument, Kuwait asserts full ownership of the field. Conversely, we contend that a border was established prior to the Islamic Revolution, entitling us to at least 30% of the field. However, Kuwait disagrees and continues to make statements opposing our claim.
Tehran has frequently proclaimed that a cooperative and respectful environment, rather than one-sided assertions, could lead to an agreement on the matter. Otherwise, the region has to prepare itself for yet another unnecessary tension.
What is Iran's position?
I believe that Tehran has taken a rational approach so far. The Iranian Minister of Foreign Affairs has maintained an open door to diplomacy. Tehran has consistently advocated for negotiations to achieve a peaceful resolution that benefits both parties.
The dispute over Arash dates back to the 1960s when Iran and Kuwait were granted overlapping offshore concessions for the field, which has been called a treasure under the sea.
Mr. Hamidreza Salehi is the Director General of Federation of Iranian Energy Export Industries.
As you know, Iran has numerous shared fields with neighboring countries in the region. The largest joint field is with Qatar, known as South Pars, which significantly contributes to the country's gas production. There are several oil and gas fields that are shared with our neighboring countries. Among these fields is Arash, which has been a subject of dispute. As a member of the private sector, we'd like to invest in the field for future generations, albeit in a peaceful cooperation with the rest of the region.
Iran assigned rights to the Anglo-Iranian oil company while Kuwait gave its share to Royal Dutch Shell, leading to overlapping claims in the northern part of the reservoir. The two concessions overlapped in the northern part of the field. According to Reuters, the Arash field reserves are estimated at 1 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, of which 200 billion cubic feet are likely to be extracted immediately, in addition to over 310 million barrels of oil. These figures are of significant importance to the Kuwaiti side, as considering Kuwait's natural gas reserves, which do not exceed 35 trillion cubic meters, the hydrocarbon value of the field could increase Kuwait's reserves by 30%. Mr. Hamid Hosseini is a senior energy expert and chief executive of the monthly Dunyaye Enerji, or the World of Energy.
What is the significance of the Arash field?
The Arash field holds approximately 570 billion cubic meters of gas and contains nearly 310 million barrels of oil, making it a valuable resource for countries like Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, which have few, if any, gas fields. The Arash field holds even greater significance, as they rely on gas imports for their domestic needs, refineries, and other purposes. They have a vested interest in accessing the Arash field's resources as soon as possible. That is while Iran is not in a rush, as it has an abundance of gas fields within its territory.
As for Iran, nearly 40% of Arash field is located in Iranian waters. In 2001, the National Iranian Oil Company drilled an exploratory well to determine the amounts of its reserves. Kuwait then threatened to take the issue to international arbitration, and following the Kuwaiti emir's visit to Tehran during the Khatami administration, Tehran stopped exploration and removed the platform built at the site. Mr. Hosseini added that for Iran, having good relationships with neighbors is very important, and the country is not happy to escalate tensions in the region for energy.
Iran was the first country in the region to drill the first oil well. Iran was also the pioneer in conducting marine explorations to discover oil and gas fields in the region. The Arash oil field was founded in the 1960s by a Japanese company working under the commission of the National Iranian Oil Company. Prior to the Islamic Revolution, Iran had discovered the field and chosen the name Arash for it. Today, Iran shares nearly 30 joint oil and gas fields with countries like Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, and Iraq. The Arash field is just one example. The South Pars gas field, the largest in the world, is shared with Qatar, and despite its significant size, representing over 15% of the world's gas reserves, Iran has accepted Qatar's two-thirds ownership. This demonstrates Iran's honesty and commitment to maintaining good relations with its neighbors. In fact, maintaining positive relationships with neighboring countries has always been a priority for Iran.
Iran's drilling and then its decision to halt it, in fact, came a year after Saudi Arabia and Kuwait had jointly started exploration and development activities on the field without Tehran's knowledge. In 2016, Iranian media reported that Saudi Arabia and Kuwait had formed the Al-Khafji joint operations to develop the field on a 50-50 joint venture without any right for Iran.
I believe that fostering better political interactions among the involved nations could have allowed all parties to reap the benefits of the Arash field more effectively. The strained relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia negatively impacted the project's progress, ultimately leading to a partnership between Kuwait and Saudi Arabia that excluded the Islamic Republic of Iran. Improved diplomatic relations among the three countries might facilitate a more inclusive and mutually beneficial approach to the development of the Arash field.
The Islamic Republic has strongly objected to the agreement, with officials saying the move is illegal as the boundaries of the field shared between the three countries have not yet been established. Tehran has repeatedly called for a border demarcation agreement to determine its right to exploit part of the field.
The Arash field situation could pose a challenge to Iran's national integrity, and it necessitates a proactive and efficient collaboration among the involved countries. Establishing clear boundaries and fostering open communication can help mitigate such disputes. By working together and defining their respective territories, the involved parties can find a resolution that benefits all.
In March 2022, Saudi Arabia's energy minister signed a document with his Kuwaiti counterpart to develop the Arash Dora gas field to produce 1 billion standard cubic feet per day of gas and 84,000 barrels per day of condensates. Iran's Minister of Petroleum, Javad Oji, was quick to respond to his Saudi counterpart's announcement then, saying Tehran would soon begin drilling at the Arash field. Although we want to negotiate and cooperate for development of joint fields, unilateral measures will not prevent the implementation of the project, he said, after Kuwait and Saudi Arabia signed a document to build the offshore reservoir without Tehran's participation.
From March 2023 onwards, the debate over the Arash field has been under intense scrutiny. A joint committee comprising the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Geography Organization of the Armed Forces, and the Ministry of Oil has been assigned to analyze various aspects of the issue. They have made a number of decisions so far. The Ministry of Oil has explicitly stated its readiness for any potential outcomes. In a sense, Iran is ready to deliver a suitable response in the upcoming period if the opposing party insists on their current position.
There's plenty more to be said, but first a quick media review to give other outlets a chance to get a word in. Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of this program. Here we'll go over some important news headlines. Iran says a unilateral claim to Arash gas field will create no rights for claimants. Iran has repeatedly announced its principled stance on the issue based on international law, underlined Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani. Shana writes, the spokesman made the remarks during his weekly press conference in reaction to a statement issued by the Ministerial Council of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, which claims only Saudi Arabia and Kuwait have the rights to exploit the field known as Al Dura in the two Arab states. We have emphasized the continuation of technical and legal talks with Kuwait officials, he pointed out. Unilateral claim on Arash gas field creates no rights for claimants, Iran says. Tehran Times writes, Iran has repeatedly announced its principled stance on the issue based on international law. The country tries to create a positive and constructive atmosphere to develop its relations with neighbors, refuting such issues in one-sided statements as not acceptable. Iran issues fresh warning against Kuwait over Arash gas field row. Iran says it believes in integrated and joint extraction with Kuwait and Saudi Arabia from the disputed Arash gas field in the Persian Gulf, warning Tehran will start drilling in the field if Kuwait does so. Iran News Daily writes, the Iranian Vice President for Legal Affairs, Mohammad Dehghan, reiterated on Thursday that the ownership dispute should be resolved through dialogue. Arash is an oil and gas field and part of it belongs to us. We do not have a maritime border with Kuwait, but we discovered the field and drilled rigs there many years ago without taking advantage of it. So we won't create tensions with our neighbors, Dehghan clarified. The Arash gas field dispute, a thorny issue in Persian Gulf politics. IUVM Press writes, the Arash oil gas field serves as a poignant symbol of the intricate geopolitical dance unfolding among Iran, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. Over time, what began as a cooperative effort has degenerated into a contentious focal point, sparking debates surrounding resource distribution and territorial delineation. Nestled within this shared expanse lies the Arash gas field, boasting a substantial storage capacity of 1 trillion cubic feet alongside an estimated 42 million barrels of crude oil. Thank you for joining us in this section. I invite you to go back to the main narrative.
In last August, Tehran officially invited Kuwaiti Foreign Minister Salem Abdullah al-Jaber al-Sabah to de-escalate tensions.
It is important to highlight our strong connections with Kuwait. For instance, Iranians have had a significant presence in Kuwait for over a century. The people of both nations have enjoyed meaningful interactions over the years. Additionally, there have been numerous joint investments in both Iran and Kuwait. With the rest improvement in relations between Tehran and Riyadh, we aim to achieve a similar level of collaborative investment with Saudi Arabia. I believe that promoting cooperation rather than competition is the best way towards a brighter future.
However, the Supreme Council of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council torpedoed de-escalation efforts at the end of its 44th summit in Doha, Qatar, claiming that the entirety of the Arash gas field lied within Kuwait's maritime territories. The council also said the ownership of natural resources in the submerged area adjacent to the Saudi-Kuwaiti divided area, including the entire gas field, is exclusively a joint ownership between Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. According to the statement, both have exclusive rights to exploit the natural resources in that area, adding, the council firmly rejected any claims of rights by any other party in this field or the submerged area adjacent to the demarcated area between Saudi Arabia and Kuwait.
Has there been any attempts to reach a deal?
As far as I know, the Kuwaitis and Saudis have been insisting on their position.
At the same time, delegations from Iran and Kuwait have been engaging in back-and-forth discussions, yet so far, no substantial agreement has been reached. I hope that both Kuwaitis and Saudis refrain from adopting more controversial positions to prevent escalating tensions among these three neighboring nations. I believe that direct negotiations would be beneficial.
The Council statement came after both Saudi Arabia and Kuwait announced in July that there was no room for negotiations with Iran regarding the Arash Dora gas field in the Persian Gulf. That's while historical records of the past 60 years show no Saudi role in negotiations between Iran and Kuwait to determine the maritime borders around the Arash field and how to exploit its resources, meaning Riyadh's push to stake out a share has started only since 2000. In reaction to the statement issued by the Supreme Council of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, National Iranian Oil Company head Mohsen Khojasemir announced that Iran was ready to begin drilling in the Arash field. He said once the necessary conditions are met, drilling operations in the Arash field will begin.
Currently, we have 26 joint fields. What if we embark on a joint venture with Saudi and Kuwait companies? They can help us with our own fields, not just the joint ones. The private sector in Iran is open to foreign investment to enhance gas extraction from our own fields. With their support, we can convert gas into LNG and export it with added value. There is significant potential for collaboration in this aspect. If we manage the situation in Arash peacefully, we can consider expanding our cooperation further. After all, we have many projects in Iran worth hundreds of billions of dollars that our neighbors can take part as investors.
For years, Iran and Kuwait have held talks over their disputed maritime border area, practically with no success. Why has the dispute remained unresolved?
There are two approaches to addressing the Arash field ownership issue. According to Iran's proposed method, it should be considered a joint field for shared use among the involved countries. However, the Kuwaitis advocate for a second approach, which would result in the field being predominantly under their ownership. Unfortunately, there is no universally accepted method to resolve this dispute. I would like to draw your attention to this point. Politicizing the case could lead to negative consequences for all parties involved. We have witnessed the politicization of Iran's share in the Caspian Sea, which has turned the issue into a complex and challenging situation for everyone. To prevent a similar destiny for the Arash field, I would like to ask the Kuwaiti authorities to refrain from politicizing the matter.
Attempts to revive negotiations have failed. Kuwait's oil minister Saad al-Barak was quoted on July 27th as saying his country would begin drilling and production at the Arash gas field without waiting for a demarcation deal with Iran. This prompted Iran's oil minister to counter, saying Tehran may pursue work at the field without an agreement. Javad Oji said, Iran will pursue its rights and interests regarding exploitation and exploration of the field if there is no desire for understanding and cooperation.
Is there any peaceful solutions to the dispute?
A potential solution to this dispute could involve finding an impartial mediator to facilitate negotiations between Iran and Kuwait. OPEC, with its Secretary General being from Kuwait, might not be the most suitable choice due to potential conflicts of interest. Alternative options for mediation could include the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or the OIC, as they have experience in resolving international disputes. Another possibility is enlisting the help of influential individuals from both countries who could act as intermediaries. Another approach could be to assign a third party to develop the Arash field and distribute the profits fairly between Iran and Kuwait. This way, both sides can avoid the direct involvement in the development project, so it could reduce tensions and foster a more cooperative atmosphere between the two nations.
The dispute between Iran and Kuwait over the Arash gas field is a complex and long-standing issue that has yet to be resolved. The competing claims, historical context, and strategic importance of the field make it a challenging matter for both countries to navigate. But the dispute for Iran is more than a row about an energy reserve. Iran shares 28 oil and gas fields with its neighbors, which constitutes the country's 20% of oil and 30% of gas reserves. And Arash is just one of them. What is at stake in the first place is the territorial integrity of the Islamic Republic. Tehran knows that a step backward might send wrong signals to the intruders. In a similar case like that of Arash, the United Arab Emirates has been laying claims of sovereignty on Iran's three islands of Greater